Are the best and most successful entrepreneurs 20-somethings? As an entrepreneur, are you over the hill at 30, not to mention 40? Let's find out from today's guest, a Kellogg professor of strategy entrepreneurship who has actually researched the correlation, or lack thereof, between age and entrepreneurial success.
Welcome to Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. Your host is Accepted's founder and world-renowned admissions guru, Linda Abraham. At Accepted, our mission is to get you to that unforgettable moment when you read your acceptance email and shout, "Yes, I'm in!" Confident you'll be attending the perfect program to help you launch the career of your dreams.
Welcome to the 352nd episode of Admission Straight Talk. Thanks for joining me today. I'd like to invite you to join me also for our next MBA webinar and the first webinar aimed exclusively at 2021 applicants. I will present 7 steps to MBA acceptance in 2021 on Wednesday, March 4th. During that webinar, I'm going to give you a plan that will prepare you for a successful MBA application in the next application cycle. The webinar is free, but you do need to reserve your seat, and you can do so at accepted.com/352webinar. I also want to share a review that was recently posted on iTunes. MBA Hopeful and Accepted wrote, "Linda does a great job of connecting you with the school-specific admissions officers, which can really help you strategize with your application. I found an episode that worked for me and listened to it multiple times to fully ingrain the message. This led to an acceptance letter for the MBA program I desired. Thanks, Linda." Thank you, MBA Hopeful and Accepted. I really appreciate you taking the time to share how Admission Straight Talk helped you to get accepted, and congratulations on your acceptance. Now, I recently stumbled across an article entitled, "It's a Disservice to Urge Young People to Become Entrepreneurs," written by Jeffrey Tucker, editorial director for the American Institute for Economic Research. The title reveals the point of the article, and Dr. Tucker bases his conclusion, at least partially, on research done by our guest today, Dr. Benjamin Jones, along with 2 other colleagues. Intrigued by the research because it is both so relevant to many of our listeners and contrary to popular belief, I invited Dr. Jones to join us, and fortunately, he accepted the invitation. Dr. Jones has a fascinating background. He earned his BSE in aerospace engineering at Princeton, his master's at Oxford, and his PhD in economics at MIT. He served as a special assistant to Larry Summers when Summers was at the U.S. Treasury Department. And in 2003, he became an assistant professor at Kellogg School of Management. In 2014, he was appointed the Gund Family Professor in Entrepreneurship and Professor of Strategy at Kellogg. Along the way, he had a long list, trust me, it really is long, of appointments and positions, including a stint at the White House and various other appointments and publications. He's agreed to join us here on Mission Straight Talk, however, in connection with his recent research on age and high growth entrepreneurship. Dr. Jones, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Hi, Linda. It's good to be with you, and thanks for your interest in this subject.
Oh, I'm fascinated by it. I'm going to get to your research in a second, but I have to ask, how did you go from aerospace engineering to Oxford to economics to entrepreneurship?
I guess one answer to that is perhaps I was a bit lost, but you know, like many, many young people, I think you're in a voyage of discovery, early in life about what you like and what you might be pretty good at. And those things tend to be correlated, tend to be happier about things we're better at. So, you know, I was very interested in engineering. I became very interested in economics and then innovation and technology. I guess a common thread there that I'm interested in application. So I'm interested in sciences that speak to society directly. Very curious about very deep science as well. But in terms of my own day-to-day work, I find a lot of joy in that sense of application.
Also, it seems to be like innovation is a thread running.
Absolutely.
Right. And maybe bursting some bubbles too. But anyways, we'll get to that in a second. What made you want to research the possible connection between age and fast growth entrepreneurship?
Well, in part because there is a very strong idea in our culture, certainly in the media, certainly in how venture capitalists often act or invest, which suggests that perhaps very young people, maybe in their 20s, are the source of the truly transformative ideas in society. So there's that sort of open question, which seemed very anecdotal in terms of the kind of evidence people brought to bear. But then separately, I was a little skeptical of it because I'd done prior research looking at Nobel Prize winners and also great inventors over the 20th century. And if you look at that data, you find that, you know, these great scientists or great inventors are not typically in their 20s. And in fact, they've gotten older and older over the course of the 20th century. Yeah. So it used to be. So, you know, before we believe that, you know, every entrepreneur should be like Mark Zuckerberg, say, you know, there was Einstein. And Einstein, when he was age 26 in 1905, did some pretty amazing things. And, you know, that led to a belief shared by many physicists and others that, you know, young people, that's really where the game is. But if you look at Nobel Prize winning research and you look at the, you know, the age, not when they win the prize, that's obviously much later in life, but the age when they do the things for which they will win the prize, you'll see that, you know, Einstein was very rare. It was never in the 20s. It was always at least age 30. But it went up by about 6 or 8 years over the course of the 20th century. So by the time we entered this century, you know, kind of your early 40s, that's actually the peak time of Nobel Prize winning breakthroughs. So that led me to have a little skepticism about this common entrepreneurship story. In some ways, they're very parallel, right? People believe it's all about young people in science. Well, maybe that's not the case, at least for the Nobel Prize winning work. What about new ventures?
That's fascinating, because I also thought that, you know, the biggest breakthroughs are people in their 20s and, let's say, early 30s. And of course, I was going to point to Einstein. I think the Wright brothers were also fairly young.
Many people are very young. And actually, that's an important point, because we're not really saying that there's one age, right? It's really about the age at which you might have the highest probability, the age where most people are. But clearly, I mean, there's no doubt that Einstein proves, just as Mark Zuckerberg may prove, that you can have really amazing, high impact, transformative ideas at very young ages. That's not really the question about whether you can. It's really the question about whether that's typical. And I think in both contexts, we find that it's actually very atypical, and that much of the work is coming in middle age.
Well, on some level, that makes sense, because you have more life experience and hopefully a little bit of wisdom that just comes from that life experience.
I think that's right. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, there's contending sort of theories. If you push on someone who has this belief that it's all about very young people, or maybe a venture capitalist who actually bets real money on that proposition, and you ask, you know, what are they thinking? I think there's sort of three different reasons you typically hear. And the first one is that young people are just not beholden to a established way of thinking. They're not sort of trapped in the current paradigm. And so they can have more outside the box kind of transformative ideas. They're sort of fundamentally more creative. That's one idea you hear. Second is just that people, when they're young, might be cognitively sharper, at least in some ways. It's sort of the idea that maybe raw deductive power or mathematical skill or programming skill or chess playing, and some of these types of tasks might favor the younger mind. And then the third issue might just be that young people sort of don't have a whole lot of other responsibilities, and they have a lot of energy, and they're just easy to, they can focus 100 hours a week, you know, eating pizza for dinner every night, you know, no problem. Right. Whereas, you know, later in life, that's not quite so easy. But I think, you know, to your point, Linda, the you know, since it does turn out that it seems like it's middle-aged people who start the highest growth companies on average, as it is with a lot of breakthroughs in science, something else, I mean, those features may be true, right? But there's something else pushing against it. And I think a leading candidate is just experience, that we actually have more wisdom, we know more, we have more different things in our minds, both for our creative inputs, but also for our capacity to execute an idea.
How did you go about your research?
Well, so this question about age and entrepreneurship is one I've wanted to ask for a long time. In fact, I wrote that paper about Nobel Prize winners in 2003. It was part of my own PhD thesis. But one of the things that limits us in our dreams and research often is the instruments or tools, or in this case, the data. You know, with Nobel Prize winners, they went out by hand and, you know, collected and read the biographies of them all and found out when they did the thing for which they would receive the prize. With entrepreneurship, you know, you really want to look systematically. So I had a fortuitous connection to people at the U.S. Census Bureau. And in some ways, if you think like telescopes and the Hubble telescope are kind of this great public tool of astronomers, you know, for social scientists, the U.S. Census Bureau and other things like it are kind of the telescopes of economics. And it's an opportunity not to look at a sample of data, but to look at all the data. So the U.S. Census has data on every single establishment of every business in the country, and you know how many employees there are, what their sales are. And only recently were they able to connect information about founders. So only recently was it possible. We've seen which companies are new, which ones grow, but we didn't know who was who in terms of the founders, or be able to connect back into any kind of demographic information such as age. And so with this new data opportunity, with a team, including Javier Miranda at Census, as well as Danny Kim, who was formerly a PhD student, now a professor at Wharton, and also a part-time Census employee, and another colleague, Pierre Azoulay, at MIT, we collectively set out on this path with this data and tried to, answer this question that had been in our minds for a long time.
Wonderful. Fascinating. I guess we just touched a little bit on why 45-year-olds do well as entrepreneurs. Did you discover anything else in terms of a correlation between age and entrepreneurship?
Sure. We aimed that paper squarely at the age question, but we also tried to look at some other relevant pieces of information in that data. And I should say, by the way, while I was skeptical that it was people in their 20s, I did not expect the answer to be 45. None of us did. I thought it might be maybe 35, 33, yeah. 37. I wasn't really expecting 45. So that's really quite surprising.
And is that about, yeah. I know, is there any, should I say, I don't know exactly how old you are, but is it perhaps a personal kind of bias there?
Well, let me give you, without disclosing my own age, that's knowable. I can tell you that I'm slightly past the peak, unfortunately. No, but actually, a different way of looking at the data is as follows. So one of the reasons it is 45 on average is because it turns out that most people who try to start companies in the United States are really not in their 20s. It's actually not common. The vast majority of people trying to start companies are, in fact, in middle age, in their 40s. So one of the reasons we see the highest growth companies coming from people in their 40s is because, if you will, to use a baseball metaphor, they take many more swings at the bat, right? They have many more at bats, so they have more home runs, okay? So a different way to ask the question, which you can also do in the data, is to say, well, let's try to control for that. So let's say, like, conditional on swinging the bat, conditional on trying. So take the 20-year-olds who try it, 25-year-olds, 26-year-olds, the 45-year-old, the 59-year-old, the 72-year-old, take everybody by age who tried, started a company, and then ask, what was your probability of a home run, a super high growth company, given that you tried? And actually what you see then is a picture that's slightly different. It's not about peaking at 45. It's basically a linear increase in your probability of success as you age.
Really?
Okay, so your actually batting average, if you will, is highest actually in the data at age 59.
Really?
Okay. All right. People with the lowest batting averages are in their 20s.
Not for me.
So I don't know where I'm not going to make any claims about anybody's age, but it's a pretty optimistic picture, because it actually, if you think of what that says, it says that people are just typically getting better at this. That's the sort of wisdom is winning at some level. Now, of course, there aren't that many 59-year-olds who do start companies, but those who do, they clearly do quite well on average. And that was, I think, quite an interesting and optimistic result.
Did you do any research on, like, how many people tried prior businesses? So in other words, is there any correlation between achieving success after having not so much success prior, or a failure before?
Yeah, that's a great question. When we looked at briefly, unfortunately, this data, we can't identify in many prior years if you were a founder in prior years. So it's a little hard to say. If you might have been a founder 10 years before and been successful, or having failed, we can't see that. We can see if you just recently started a company, in the few years before.
Right.
And if that's true, it does turn out that having had a prior success greatly increases your chance of a future success. And we found a few other things that are predictive. I think perhaps the most interesting one here, because it goes back to that very question about whether young people have this advantage from coming outside the area, not being trapped in a certain way of thought.
Right.
So we do see the work histories of all the founders. So we know where they worked, and we know what sector they worked in, what narrow industry of the economy. And just a little bit of data aside, the census codes up every sector of the economy into, six-digit codes. You get 3,000 or so different sectors. So these are very specific sectors. And what we see is that if you start a company in exactly the new venture is in exactly the same narrow industry code as where you have worked, your chances of a home run go up by 2.5 times.
Wow.
So contrary to the idea that you kind of want to come from outside the industry, we actually see that people who are coming from right inside that very narrow industry seem to have a huge success rate advantage.
And to what do you attribute that?
Well, so this gets back, I mean, it gets back to your wisdom point. But I think, you know, if you think about how we teach entrepreneurship these days, or how we think about innovation or in a corporation or any setting, or even how I think about it in a basic research context, like in a university or a government lab, you know, you really want to, the first thing you want to do is understand a problem, right? You want to understand a real problem that somebody has, right? And then when you understand a real problem, then you know there's really kind of a value proposition in solving it. And you can begin to iterate your creativity against that problem. And I think so, if you think about what's going on, when you're coming from within a very narrow industry, you know, like for example, I'm never going to have an idea about a better, you know, hybrid engine for a car. I'm never going to have an idea about how to reformat the market structure in say, reinsurance industries, you know, some business service. I'm not going to see the problems in legal services and how to revolutionize that space because I don't work in legal services. I mean, I might have that idea. It's not that I can't, but anyone could. But what are your chances really of having a true insight about a true problem? And so I think, you know, there's a big advantage to sort of being in the environment where these problems are generated that assists your creativity in a big way.
Well, I think you, I would assume that your intimate knowledge of the industry would allow you to see the problems that need solving. You might come up with a great idea on how to innovate in higher ed.
Right, exactly. And that's probably where I should direct my creativity. So, you know, coming back to young people, and, you know, young people can be very successful at entrepreneurship. If you think about it, a lot of that is doing things that are services to young people.
That's right. Right.
So like social media that is used by people in that generation, or, you know, it could be delivering food at night, or, you know, it could be getting from one point to another using a car service like Uber or something like
right.
that. I think, you know, there's a case where you are the user, and so you understand the problems you're trying to solve, and you may actually have a very accurate understanding of that problem, maybe even an insight that an older person wouldn't have because they don't sort of have the same sort of consumption or cultural behaviors that you do. So I think, you know, there are going to be places where young people are going to have particularly good ideas that are relevant to their own interests. But it's the same framing of understanding a particular real problem.
And, you know, I'm sure you can speak to this much more than I can. I've interviewed a couple of MBA students who are currently also business founders. They were almost all developing a service that was starting out by serving other students. They
right.
identified a pain point, whether it was travel, I'm thinking of one or two were for student loans, different
yep.
means of financing student loans.
Yep.
And they were developing that for that particular, for the segment that they were a part of. And they were intimately
right.
familiar with the problem and the pain point. So that would,
yep.
that makes sense.
Yeah. I make a joke about, you know, we talk about B2B, right? Businesses, yeah. B2C businesses. And I sometimes say B2Me because I think, you know, when you're an entrepreneur, if it's about you, if you're one of the consumers, well, you've got your first beta customer already, and you're likely to have a product that at least somebody wants because you want it yourself. And so I think these sort of B2Me businesses can actually be pretty good ideas, relatively speaking.
What would you advise a you know, young adult, a 20-something, let's just say, whether a student, an MBA student, and you're a professor of entrepreneurship, who says, I have a great idea for a business?
I guess my first question would always be, why do you think it's a great idea? And that's when I'd want to start hearing about a real problem that they think they have an insight on. And I'd want to know why that's a problem and how they know it's a problem, who they've talked to, and have they confirmed it that it's a problem? Do they have any, you know, what's their information set? And I think that's the first ingredient, right? That's the key ingredient. Without that, you know, without an idea that solves a problem, where is there to go here? And then I think there's a question about capabilities, right? And I would say that to a young entrepreneur, just like I'd say that to any organization. So you say you want to innovate in some direction, but do you have the interior internal capabilities to execute against that problem? And if the answer to that is no, that doesn't mean you're done. It just means you got to find collaborators. It means you have to recognize what you can do and what you can't do. And you have to build, a team that's going to have the requisite knowledge. And, you know, and so I think, you know, there are a lot of, you know, 20-something people who have really good ideas, probably don't have a lot of management experience, right? Whether it's finance and accounting or marketing or sales or just running a meeting or running a team. And there could be a lot of innate skill there. And it may be so much innate skill, in fact. I think some entrepreneurs I know who are just, they're just really innately good at entrepreneurship. Yeah. They have so much innate skill, they're going to do well anyway. And that's, those are the people who are the rare cases who are going to succeed at a very young age. And the good news, they're even they're going to get better. Their experience is only going to help them. But I think for other people, you have to sort of reflect a little bit and say, I've never done this before. Do I really know how to do it? Should I then wait or should I collaborate? And who could kind of come in and fill in my gaps and be honest about your own gaps, because everybody has gaps, and build an effective organization that can take your idea forward.
Right. Our son one time came to us and said, you know, I want to start a business. And he gave us his business idea. And we thought it was a terrible idea. Of course, he was looking for us to invest in it. We thought it was a poor idea. And one of his reasons was, look, you know, I'm not married. I don't have kids now. Now's the time for me to try this. Or somebody else, it wasn't him, comes and says, I have this great idea, but I'm afraid it's going to, you know, it'll disappear if I wait till I gain life experience or get an MBA or do whatever. In your case, obviously, the key thing would be get an MBA. What would your reaction to that be? Would it be similar to what you just answered? Or
I mean, I
specifically.
Think, so people should be a little careful to think that just because they had the idea, they're the only one. I mean, ideas are typically in the air. Something an old sociologist, Robert K. Merton, we call Merton multiples. You know, people end up kind of racing at the same idea. There are plenty of people who try to do social media companies.
Oh, yeah.
You may remember MySpace.
Right.
When you think about it, Facebook, because they won. You know, there are a lot of companies doing search. Everyone's doing different kinds of search. And then Google kind of had the right algorithm, but it had a lot more than that. It's not just they had some one idea about an algorithm and then they won. It's not that at all. There's a continual out execution that has to happen in an organization between companies that are new startups or otherwise that are racing towards a very similar idea. So you have to sort of ask yourself about why you think you're going to out execute the idea, right? And you might have a little bit of a head start if you really had a unique insight, but it's not going to be unique for long. And, you know, if we're talking about deep tech, we could talk about patenting, and that's a different kind of strategy, which could be very useful. But I think for a lot of things, that's not really the right strategy. And then your source, you have to believe that you can out execute. And so I think, you know, that's where you go into either it's a good idea, but I'm not going to win because I don't think I'm ready to execute it compared to everyone else who can execute it. Or I am going to execute it well, but I'm going to do it through collaboration with people who can really help me. You know, we better be good as a team here because we're probably not the only ones trying to do this. And, you know, I think, you know, the other comment you made is, you know, someone asks you for your support. And I say, how do you know it's a great idea? And you're going to ask a lot of people if your idea is a good idea, and they may tell you it's not. So you have to be a little careful about just taking negative advice as a reason to shut down. But I think you have to listen to who is telling you that. I mean, if someone tells you that because they have some, you know, deep wisdom about the exact space you're working in, I would listen very seriously to that. They know the institutional knowledge, the regulations, the existing players, and they have a whole bunch of articulatable reasons about why it's not going to work. Then you should be very careful. Someone's just like, I don't know. I don't think I would buy that. That's not the right test at all because, you know, people buy different things. I mean, not everyone is a representative consumer, and you don't have to hit every consumer in the world to be a successful idea. You need to hit some. But it's very important that you find some people who think it's a great idea and you can articulate why.
All right, great. What qualities other than maturity contribute to being a successful entrepreneur?
I think grit. I mean, first and foremost.
Okay.
I've yet to meet an entrepreneur who's a successful entrepreneur who said, oh yeah, it was easy. I just had this idea and 2 weeks later it was all working fine. I think every company is a struggle. You have good days, hopefully, but you definitely have bad days always. And you're going to have days where you're wondering why you're doing this and is it going to work? And there's just problems and problems. So you have to be able to work through failure. And you have to sort of have the gritty psychology to do that, whether that's a competitive sense, but just something that's giving you that kind of toughness and an ability to step back. I think a lot of that grit, by the way, is not purely an individual quality. I think support networks are very important to entrepreneurs. Like, you know, if you're isolated and it's not going well, that's very hard to handle. But if you have mentors, networks, family and friends who can sort of help you when it's you know, just talk to you and kind of help encourage you or give you advice when things are tough. I think that can be very, very useful.
Okay, great. Now, some people, among them Andy Kessler in the Wall Street Journal, argue that the MBA just isn't worth the investment anymore. Now, as listeners know, I actually commented on this a few weeks ago. Others say that one is better off acquiring business skills less expensively and investing the $200,000 on an entrepreneurial venture and then learning from the experience, whether success, in which case you're in pretty good shape, or failure, rather than paying MBA tuition and obviously the opportunity cost of being out of work. How would you respond to that argument?
If you thought your idea was really that good and you think it's going to work and you're really excited and you think it's, you know, it's not going to last long if you're in the marketplace, if you don't do it now, I mean, I think maybe you should go for your idea. But I think if you think you're going to, you know, fail at something and that's going to be a better life lesson, you know, you we're all going to fail at lots of things. So, you know, don't worry about that. Those lessons are coming. you know, the you know, an MBA, whether it's 2 years or 1 year, however long you're doing it, is a really short portion of your professional career. I mean, the way I think about an MBA is actually giving you, you know, maybe like the equivalent of 10 years of experience in a lot less time, because what you're going to do is you're going to fill in your gaps. You're going to get out of your silo and think more broadly. You're going to read a lot about successes and failures of all sorts of different kinds of companies, which you don't experience it yourself so painfully and for so long. You're going to learn from a lot of failure, and you're going to do it in a structured way. You're also going to build networks that are going to be valuable to you. I mean, I guess if you empirically speaking, you know, the returns to professional education in the United States, whether it's an MBA or a law degree or a medical degree, have never been higher historically. You know, there's a reason. There's a lot of skill developed, a lot of ability developed through these programs. The return to venture capital, I'm not sure it's never been lower, but it's not like this is
lower or higher. The return to venture capital has never been lower or higher.
Well, it's never that high. I mean, I think that you know, let's be realistic. The professional educations give you a huge wage boost and lots of opportunity going forward. You're not really foreclosing the entrepreneurial possibility. Keeping in mind that people tend to peak when they're 45. You know, that's sort of what do you see? You see people doing a lot of great things, coming out of industry experience, solving problems they understand, you know, doing more higher probability, lower risk, potentially very, very remunerative forms of entrepreneurship later. So I don't know. It doesn't have to be the same answer for everybody, but I think failure is a good teacher, but I think an MBA is a pretty good teacher too.
Yeah. And what do you think of the fail fast, fail often mantra?
Fine, but don't fail exclusively. No, if you're gonna fail, failing fast is a good idea. I mean, that comes back to our ideas about successful entrepreneurship and creativity, which is, you know, if you're not finding that customer for your solution, you know, pivot, you know, edit,
yeah,
find a better solution, standard sort of lean startup kind of thinking. And then if you really can't find anything even narrow in the space, then shut down entirely and redeploy. You know, so I think, you know, stubbornly chasing ideas that clearly aren't working is never a good idea. So knowing how to abandon and being willing to abandon, that's another form of psychological toughness, I think, because it's very hard to sometimes, you know, give up. You know, you want to be gritty, but you have to be wise at the same time. Deploy that grit to a better direction, not to a failing one.
Well, grit sometimes means that you also acknowledge you started down the wrong path and you got to start a new one.
Yeah, exactly. So I think honesty, I mean, it's self-reflection and honesty. And that goes both to that, you know, allowing yourself to move on to a new entrepreneurial venture or something else. But it also goes back to that first thing we're talking about, which is just understanding your own strengths and weaknesses. And I think, you know, no one's good at everything. So just, you know, maybe you're not good at sales. So hire someone who's really good at sales. You know, maybe you're not so good at whatever, you know, some operational functions, you know, hire someone who's good at that. You know, you don't have to be the lead engineer and the lead finance person and the lead cheerleader and the, you know, you need to find a team that can make you better. And so I think that requires that kind of self-reflection and gritty honesty as well.
It's interesting that in the MBA admissions process, of course, one of the things that the top business schools are looking for is self-awareness.
Yeah.
It's very much sought after by all admissions officers.
Right. You know, or 360 reviews, these kinds of things, very powerful. Yeah. If you're willing to open yourself up, you can really push yourself forward.
And if you do the self-reflection, your application will be stronger and you'll have a better chance of acceptance. So there's a little bit of a virtuous circle there.
Absolutely.
Right. What would you have liked me to ask you?
Well, these are great questions, Linda. I think they're all, it's been a great conversation. I guess another aspect of this is maybe the broader social stakes, kind of one thing to emphasize, and maybe this puts wind in the sails of those who are thinking about entrepreneurial careers at any age, you know, or innovative careers. And maybe evidence from the research side, it's just very clear that the social society returns to innovative activity and entrepreneurship is much, much greater than the private returns garnered by the individual. Now, the private returns might be good, and of course, in some cases, we know they're spectacular, but the social returns are truly enormous, and it's very hard for the innovator or the entrepreneur to capture all the returns. I mean, all the downstream users of the product are better off, for example, and are obviously capturing a lot of the value. And so, you know, in general, we think that, you know, I'll be an economist for a second, be a bit pointy-headed. You know, economists think that the failure to innovate enough, the failure to devote enough resources to new venture creation, et cetera, is one of the main market failures in the economy. Because the social returns are so large compared to the private returns, we basically don't do it enough. And I think there's so many problems that people are well situated to solve. And taking that jump into an innovative and creative mindset can not only pay off for them, in fact, it's not always entirely clear it'll pay off for them so greatly, but it'll certainly pay off for society by trying those routes out. And I think that's something we should all keep in mind. And one of the reasons I think we want to encourage this activity and figure out how to get everyone involved and learn, be honest and gritty, but also to kind of help people make innovative choices at the right place, the right time, and the right direction, so that we can all benefit from that effort.
Great. That's a fascinating point. Thank you very much. Dr. Jones, thank you so much for joining me today. Where can listeners and potential applicants learn more about you?
The Kellogg website, you can find my biography and as well on the faculty pages of the Kellogg website, as well as links to my research and things like that.
Okay, great. We'll include links in the show notes at exhibit.com/352, both to Dr. Jones' bio page at Kellogg and to the American Institute for Economic Research article based on Dr. Jones and his colleagues' work and research. Listeners, thank you too for joining Dr. Jones and me for the 352nd episode of Admission Straight Talk. Just a quick reminder, register for 7 Steps to MBA Acceptance in 2021, a free webinar that I will present on Wednesday, March 4th. The webinar is free, but please save your seat. You can do so at exhibit.com/352webinar. Our 352nd episode is just about over. Don't miss any other shows, be they with fascinating professors, informative admissions directors, insightful students and alumni, or educational test prep pros. Subscribe so that you get them all. Thank you again for listening. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.